Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, October 15th, 2025, we are delighted to host a discussion following the oral arguments before the Delaware Supreme Court for In Re Tesla Inc. derivative litigation. My name is Matthew Sawtell, and I am Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, we'll keep the introductions brief, but you can access our panelists' full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us the Honorable Myron Steele as our speaker, and Professor Robert Miller as our moderator. Professor Miller is professor of law and an Allison Dorothy Rouse chair in law at George Mason University's Antonin Scalia Law School. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them through the question and answer feature in Zoom, but we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. We do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. With that, thank you for being with us today. Professor Miller, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for having us. As Matthew said, I'm a law professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, and I am honored and very pleased to be joined by Myron Steele, former Chief Justice of the State of Delaware. Before serving on the Supreme Court, he was a Vice Chancellor on the Court of Chancery and a judge in the Delaware Superior Court. It's hard to imagine anyone who knows Delaware and Delaware law better than the former Chief Justice. Chief Justice, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And as Matt said, we're going to be talking about In Re Tesla derivative litigation. This is the Elon Musk compensation case, an extraordinary case by any standard. I assume most people on the call know what has happened in the case so far, but I will briefly recap it. Everyone knows who Elon Musk is. He's the richest man in the world and the CEO of Tesla. And back in 2018, back when Tesla was a fledgling car company worth, you know, less than a mere $50 billion, his prior executive compensation package had been completed and he needed a new one. He began to negotiate one with an independent committee, or what purported to be an independent committee of the Tesla board. And the result was a truly extraordinary deal. With an all-equity compensation package, it came in 12 tranches of stock. For Musk to get a tranche, he had to increase the value of the company by $50 billion. He had to more than double its then existing market cap. And for each subsequent tranche, he had to increase the market cap by $50 billion and meet certain operational goals. In the end, to collect all 12 tranches, he had to increase the value of the company by $600 billion and meet the various operational goals. But if he did that, he would get an extraordinary reward. He would get options worth, in the aggregate, about $56 billion, about a tenth of the value that had been created in the market cap of the company. At the time, everybody thought this was entirely unrealistic. One publication called the goals laughably impossible. Well, as everyone knows, they weren't impossible. They were, in fact, quite possible, at least for Elon Musk, because, in fact, all those goals were hit and indeed exceeded. During the life of the package, he increased the company's market cap not 12 times, but more like 14 times. And he earned the full value of the package, again, about $56 billion. Well, a shareholder sued, claiming that this package was unfair to the company and too generous to Musk. And that case finally went to trial years later, in late 2013 and in early 2014, the Delaware Court of Chancery held that, in fact, that was correct and voided the package. In a very long opinion, the court held that the directors who were on the committee that approved the package were in fact controlled by Musk or beholden to him. applying what has been called the transaction-specific controller doctrine. The court found that Musk wasn't a mathematical controller. He had less than 22% of the shares. He didn't exercise general control over Tesla, but he did control the approval of this particular transaction. Moreover, although the transaction had been submitted to the shareholders of the company, the independent shareholders, and they voted to approve the transaction with more than 70% of the vote, that approval was ineffective because the disclosure made to those shareholders was incomplete or misleading. So the transaction had to be reviewed under Delaware's most stringent standard, the entire fairness standard, and it failed that as well. It failed it because the process was unfair, the court held, and in fact, the price was unfair. It's not entirely clear from the chancellor's opinion, but it seems that the chancellor held that the correct price or the fair price would have been zero, not $56 billion. After that, the action of the case actually continues because having lost at chancery, the directors at Tesla realized that they had to compensate Musk in some way or other for what he had done over the last several years. And they opted to resubmit the package as it was to the shareholders, asking them to ratify it anyway, despite the holdings of the Court of Chancery. And the shareholders did. Once again, about 72 or 73% of the shares voted in favor. And then this went back to Chancery, and the Chancery Court held that this ratification was legally ineffective, and it Chancery rescinded the package in its entirety, and then awarded the plaintiff's lawyers involved in the litigation a fee of $345 million, the largest fee in Delaware history. So we have a lot of tremendous numbers here. We have a tremendous growth in the value of Tesla, whose market cap today stands at over $1 trillion. We have the largest pay package in human history, as one of the lawyers in the oral arguments pointed out this morning, $56 billion. And we also have the largest plaintiff's lawyer's fee in Delaware history at $345 million. All this was argued over at the Delaware Supreme Court this morning, where all the issues are on appeal. The Chief Justice and I watched those oral arguments this morning. They were extremely well done. And let me begin by asking you, Chief Justice, what was your initial impression watching the oral arguments this morning?
Well, as you just stated, my initial impression was it was really a superb oral argument. There were good questions from the bench, very pointed questions. I wouldn't call it a hot bench, but there were questions that were clearly relevant to the core issues and questions that at the same time disguised what the position that the justice individually might ultimately have on the very issue they were questioning counsel about. The focus was of the argument was in all the right places, and I would encourage anyone listening to this presentation or watching this presentation to go to the archives in the Delaware Supreme Court website and watch the argument for yourself if you didn't already do so. For me, the most intriguing question that I think will be and should be the court's focus, although I'm very reticent about suggesting to a court on which I once served what it should do now. That's inappropriate under the Delaware way, as we call it. So there's nothing I say about the argument is meant to be critical of the court at all. But I did reminisce about the fact that this was yet another argument I wish had gone on, like the old House of Lords argument, for as long as it took for everybody to have what they had to say and for every question to be asked and answered. It was an argument that was clearly, in my mind, too short, but excellently performed by counsel and good questions from the court. The focus was on what I think will be a very critical issue for the court to resolve, and that is, what is the so-called transaction-specific control issue supposed to look like under Delaware law? Determining what is a controller outside the M&A context when you're dealing with a compensation package is not necessarily unique, but there needs to be greater clarity in that area than exists today. And this case, I think, pinpoints that weakness that needs to be corrected. And it's not one, because as I assume everyone watching this understands, every case is fact specific. So nothing is necessarily automatically relevant to the newer case with a different set of facts. But the core issue here that's really important, I think, is what constitutes a controller. And I think the opinion that comes from this court is going to clarify that. And I would recommend to anyone listening the new paper done by Professor Pullman at Penn and Vice Chancellor Will, The Lost History of Transaction-Specific Control, is very much worth a read. And I hope that the Supreme Court heard this argument, reads it, as I'm sure they will, because it speaks to this as somewhat of a murky response to a weakly constituted concept of transaction-specific controller, when you have neither of the major issues found as a matter of fact. A majority of the stock owned by the controller, so where the controller could remove the board, controller could amend the bylaws, the controller could amend possibly the charter, depending on the amount of shares. And the concept that in order to be a controller, the second step is you have to have an active control of the business itself, not just be there with the title and have, in this case, 21 to 27% of the shares at any particular time, less than one third. It's a far reach. And there's also an excellent amicus brief that is filed addressing the harm that this concept may do to brilliant people throughout the country, not necessarily only in Silicon Valley, but throughout the country, who were founders of organizations and made successful steps that enriched their stockholders. And putting a damper on that is not a wise move if the stockholders fully inform, approve, have submitted to them for a vote, and approve the actions taken in this compensation package. As Professor Miller already pointed out, 70% plus, I can't remember whether 71, then 73, or 70 and then 72, but a substantial majority of the stockholders approved the package. Now, there are issues about whether they were fully informed or not, and typically in Delaware, the Supreme Court doesn't necessarily quarrel with fact-finding by the trial judge when there's some record support for it, whether the member of the Supreme Court would have done the same thing or not. That kind of review is very rarely attempted by the Supreme Court. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, not having actually heard the evidence, not having seen the people who testify, and make your own assessment of the logic of what's been said by the witnesses. But applying entire fairness in this situation, rather than the business judgment rule, where there isn't substantive evidence of Elon Musk actually doing the operations or substituting his judgment for the people that were running the company, it is, to use the trite phrase, perhaps in the mind of the justices, a bridge too far. And it needs to be, to the extent there's some uncertainty about how one interprets this transaction-specific control issue, it needs to be clarified. One of the reasons it needs to be clarified, it is unusual for the Delaware legislature to step in and make changes to the corporate code in Delaware, which reflect on issues decided by the Court of Chancery before the Supreme Court has had a chance to address them. And that's happened here. And for me, traditionalist that I am, and maybe that's a word I can actually use when I'm on a Federalist Society program, without shame. It's always been the tradition in Delaware that changes in the corporate law are vetted very carefully through all the constituencies represented on what the Delaware Bar Association calls corporate counsel. And it up until now, it has not happened in my 55 years of practice that the recommendations for change in the Delaware corporate code came from anywhere else other than corporate counsel. And that's after all constituencies have been heard, rather than an ad hoc group assembled by the governor and presented by the executive branch to the legislature, bypassing Delaware counsel. So this is one of the reasons, maybe that's too much in the weeds, but important to a Delawarean like me, that the system not be fragmented, because there's a case that it causes concerns. It should be addressed in the way it has historically been addressed. It keeps politics and out of the corporate law system in Delaware. There are plenty of other things to be political in Delaware, but not the corporate law. And I mean political with a little p as well as possibly the capital P. This case is interesting for a number of other reasons, but the main issue, I think, is going to be whether or not entire fairness was appropriately applied and whether or not the transaction-specific control gets clear, definitive explanation that can give what people expect from Delaware corporate law, which is clarity, consistency, and predictability. Right now, it's a bit in flux. But there are many other interesting issues, as Professor Miller pointed out, not the least of which is rescission the remedy here? And who had the burden of showing that there was an alternative, effective way of crafting damages, should there be damages, other than rescission? Because rescission, at least as I've always understood it, is to place the parties in the place they were before the wrong was done. This is a very different factual situation as a result of rescission. I think the justices are going to have to focus on what does rescission really mean, and who has the burden of establishing that someone has been awarded appropriately for a wrong done to them, and not someone's been inappropriately deprived of a benefit. So
that goes to one of the more pointed questions I think we heard this morning. Justice Vallejora asked counsel for both sides, had it ever happened in Delaware that the Court of Chancery, sitting in equity, had rescinded an executive compensation package with milestones built in, as they typically do, after the executive had performed and hit the milestones, and so under the terms of the package would be entitled to whatever the package says he gets. Had it ever happened that the Court of Chancery had rescinded such a package? And the appellants, of course, said, no, that's never happened. Lawyers for the stockholders, Greg Garallo, attempted to say that it had in the Valiant case. And I was surprised at how pointedly Justice Vallejora more or less told him, no, that hadn't happened in Valiant.
Yeah, the questions were, I thought, very penetrating and very helpful to understanding the dynamic if you weren't involved in the actual litigation itself. So that was a very much a positive.
Let me take you back to the transaction-specific control doctrine. And in the interest of full disclosure, I signed one of the amicus briefs, one of the professor briefs, saying that we think the transaction-specific control doctrine is a mistake. So that's my view, and it is there in public already. One of the things that people have said about transaction-specific control is this. If you're trying to figure out if someone was a transaction-specific controller, you look at primarily his or her interactions with members of the board in the approval process of the challenged transaction. And to find that the person's a transaction-specific controller, you have to show that they exercise control over the transaction. And they exercise control over at least a sufficient number of the directors who approved it. If you find such control, then the standard shifts to entire fairness. And then to apply entire fairness, you have to consider, was the process fair? Was the price fair? But when you go back and look at was the process fair, you go back and essentially look at exactly the same facts of how the transaction was initiated, negotiated, timed, and so on. And the very facts that support the idea that someone was a transaction-specific controller almost necessitate a finding that the process wasn't fair. And once that happens, right, it is theoretically possible, but very, very difficult for the whole transaction to turn out to be fair, because it all then turns on the company must have gotten one heck of a great deal on price to overcome an unfairness, a procedural unfairness finding. So it's almost like if whatever the transaction specific controller doctrine applies, the result of the entire fairness inquiry, if not completely predetermined, is almost predetermined by a finding of procedural unfairness. Do you think that's right? Does that mean the transaction specific control can't really be coherently applied, or what's your view?
I think it can't be coherently implied. I think there needs to be a more fundamental return to the more fundamental position that control should be determined from the amount of the shares and the ability of the alleged controller to effectively, as I think I stated earlier, make changes without the minority stockholders being involved in the process. And it's very clear in the M&A context that it is price and it is process. And every case that I can recall always says one can be substitute for a failing of the other, depending on how you analyze them as together. And perfection isn't what one should ordinarily expect. And in this particular case, I think the court's going to look at the abandonment of the idea of you've got to be a controller, you have to have more than a certain level of stocks, a share of stock, whether it's 35% or 50%, which is the obvious answer, 51%. You have to look at the extent to which they dominate the decision-making otherwise, running the business in its totality, not just one transaction, one case-specific set of facts before you can make the determination that there's a controller. And before, if you can't make the determination there's a controller on predictable terms for defining what's a controller, not an ad hoc analysis based upon the facts in each case, then you create the kind of predictability that one could argue, unless you chose to misread Kahn versus Lynch, that one has understood for decades to be the test. And the penultimate test is if you've got 51%, hey, there's no issue there. Other than that, it can be a real quagmire. And I think this case is an example of as far as it could possibly go without being litigated. I won't say which way it should be decided because that's not my purview, but it's something that definitely the court should tackle and put to rest, because the enemy of our corporate process is a lack of predictability. It just can't be tolerated.
So, and one of the reasons I think that makes this such a high stakes decision is that if there's this alternative route to finding someone is a controller, then as we heard recently in the Match case, any transaction between the company and the controller, not just, for example, a take private, would be subject to entire fairness. MFW would apply as the only route to get business judgment review. Do you think that, it's probably asking too much from this case, but do you think that in general, Delaware law going forward should consider the possibility that not all transactions between a controller and the company are equal? So a take private, for example, would be a last period problem in a zero-sum game, how much is the controller going to pay per share to take out the minority, might look very different from an executive comp decision between even a legitimate controller, a real controller, and the company, because it's not a zero period. It's not a zero-sum problem. The controller and the company are going to work together to create value. It's not a last period problem, because the controller and the board have to continue to work together going forward to create value at the company. These are economically important differences, I think most people would say, between a take private with a legitimate controller and an executive comp decision for a legitimate controller. But despite these economic differences, at the moment, Delaware law sees them as being exactly the same legally. They're both subject to MFW. They're both subject to entire fairness. What makes you a controller for one type of transaction makes you a controller for the other. Does Delaware law need perhaps to change in a bigger way to recognize that a take private with a controlling shareholder isn't the same necessarily the same type of transaction as other transactions between the company and the controlling shareholder?
Yeah, I don't think you can across the board frame it in a way that doesn't call for a different fact situation with perhaps a different result, but you have to have a known standard so people know how to construct the process and know what the significance is of stockholder approval. One of the things that troubles me about this case is Delaware corporate laws always strive to have the right balance between the governing and the ownership rated through shares. And only outside of a clear fiduciary duty can you ignore the right of the stockholders to make decisions once the issues are presented to them. You have to have faith in that. This case suggests that, put aside for a moment how you interpret the facts about whether the stockholders were fully informed or not, the information was there, the basic information. And the percentage of votes suggests that judges should recognize the people who have some skin in the game have made a decision here, that it's in their best interest. And there should be respect for the stockholders' decision, unless the process is so wickedly flawed that you can't trust stockholders, probably in this case, substantial number of sophisticated stockholders, make judgments when the case is the fact situation presented to them quite clearly. And I'm trying to figure out, as I read this case, where did the stockholders lose here? Where are the damages? What is it? The old Wendy's ad? Show me the beef?
Well, Greg Varallo would say they should have kept that extra $56 billion, I suppose.
Yeah. I hope he hasn't spent his $56
million. Or even his $345 million. Yeah. But of course, there were two shareholder votes here, right? There was the initial one and then the ratification one. And there was interesting discussion, I think. I believe it was mostly between the court and Jeffrey Wall for the company, about just what the second shareholder vote did, or what at least the company claims it did. And there's sort of an argument between, did the company and the shareholders attempt to, as it were, undo a decision of the Chancery Court, or did they merely attempt to moot the proposed remedy of a Chancery decision that would continue to stand? So in other words, Mr. Wall was saying, if I understood him correctly, the company could say everything in the Chancery opinion was correct. Everything that the court found to be a fault with the original process. Yes, indeed, all those faults are there. But now we've disclosed all of them to the shareholders. We even attached a copy of the Chancery opinion to the proxy. And we asked the shareholders, what do you want to do going forward? Do you want Musk to keep the package, flawed though it may well have been? Do you want us to devise some new type of package? Do you want us to try to tell Musk he gets nothing, right? They have to tell Musk something. They have to continue to make cars. They have to continue to try to make money and create value for the shareholders. How do they deal with the fact that the package was rescinded by the Court of Chancery? Do you think that it's legitimate for the company to try to ratify the package, or does the Chancery Court having invalidated it mean that it could never be ratified in the future?
Well, I certainly don't believe the latter, because Delaware's always recognized that and protected stockholder votes, stockholders' interest, as long as they were fully informed. And while there may be, again, some issues about information they might otherwise have had, was that information material is the real issue. And there should be respect for a stockholder vote, particularly when it's over 70%. And whether you want to use the term ratification or not, whether it was intended to, it was, I think, presented, one could reasonably conclude, to the stockholders so they didn't lose what they might have thought originally was a benefit for the company, and that is incentivizing someone who has done so much for them in the past and had the prospect of, with incredible milestones to meet, do much for them in the future. Whose decision ultimately is that? The courts? I mean, I think there needs to be, that there needs to be a focus on the fact that there are constituencies, and the stockholders are the most important constituencies. You can create others that are important to the success of the business, but fundamentally, those who are at risk the most are the stockholders, and whose views should be respected.
So this really takes us into the court's substantive entire fairness inquiry. And as I said at the beginning, among other things, the court looked at how similarly situated superstar CEO founders, people like Zuckerberg and Bezos, for example, are compensated at their companies. And it turns out that each of them holds, or at least at the relevant time held, an approximately equal stake to Musk, about 20% of the economic value of the company. And both of them take no compensation. They are sufficiently incentivized, those companies believe, by holding 20% of the company. For every $5 billion in value they can cause the company to increase in value, they get a billion of it, they get 20%. The counter argument, of course, was that Elon Musk has all these other companies. He has SpaceX and the AI company and so on. And he has opportunity costs that Mark Zuckerberg doesn't. He's only got Meta, for example. Reading that discussion, it reminded me of something another Chief Justice, Leo Strine, said one time in some of the appraisal cases. The appraisal cases, of course, require that the cashed-out shareholders get fair value for their shares, somewhat like in an entire fairness inquiry, the company get a fair deal, an entirely fair deal. And what Leo said in one of those cases was that fair means fair. It doesn't mean the deal that Warren Buffett negotiated on his best day could have gotten against the Lenape tribe who sold Manhattan Island for $24 400 years ago on their worst day. It's not the best possible deal for the company. It's just a fair deal for the company. Do you think that looking at how entire fairness was applied below, there might have been at least implicitly, the idea that the company needed to get the best possible deal, or at least a really, really good deal, and not just a fair deal?
Well, I have never read an opinion that said in the analysis of entire fairness that the standard wasn't fairness. It was a really, really super fair situation that had to apply. Now, I think that's not a tenable argument. That's almost an impossible job. And I don't think it helps in the opinions when you talk about superstar CEOs in leading to the possible inference that somebody's spectacularly successful, then becoming spectacularly successful on a continuum for yourself, but also enriching the people who put their trust in you when they bought shares in your company, is somehow something that should be discouraged by the law because it might it might de-incentivize people to continue to create and make money for others. So the most troubling thing for me in this case has been for, and this clearly goes into For What It Worth's department when I say for me, is the lack of respect for the stockholder vote. That's my most troublesome factor.
When Jeff Wall for the independent directors came back for his reply, he did something I thought was very interesting. He sort of said, not in so many words, but this was, I think, the implication. Assuming you're going to vote for us, judges, there were three ways you could do it. He said you could find for us on control, meaning I would assume there's no transaction-specific controller doctrine. Musk wasn't a controller, therefore it's business judgment review. And of course, under that standard, the package would survive. Or you could hold for us by saying, even if the package was bad, rescission was the wrong remedy. Or you could hold for us by saying the ratification of the second vote was effective. Without you're implying which way the court should vote or should hold. If you think that, if in fact they're going to hold for Musk and the company and against the shareholder plaintiffs, which do you think is the most likely? Do you think they go down the control route, the rescission remedy route, or the ratification route? Presumably, they're only, if they do this, they're only going to do one. They're not going to decide more than they need to. But if they're going to decide for Musk and the company, which one do you think it's going to be? Control, rescission, or ratification?
Well, rather than characterize it as which do I think it's going to be, I would characterize, say, the one I would most like them to address is the control issue in this context. That's where the clarity is needed. And however they rule could have implications substantially down the road for our law and interest in Delaware law. The others are interesting issues, but I think this concept of transactional control is the one that needs to be addressed.
I would agree with that. I think they're fascinating legal issues, and I can just imagine the wonderful questions I could create for a final exam for students based on the others, but they both strike me as being very unlikely to ever reoccur. And for that reason,
you're right about that. And there's an old saw in the Delaware bar that the one thing you can count on when you get the bar exam questions, first thing you do when think about a corporate law section, look for the most important case decided in the last 2 years. And that's what the question is going to be focused on.
And you think this will be the most important case decided in the last couple of years?
I think it's the most important case decided in the last 10.
So going back to MFW or Corwin.
Yeah, they were important. And then my personal favorite, which I won't mention because I dissented, which I didn't do very often. But anyway, this is a clearly a monumental case. Not just exciting because of the factual players involved, but because of the doctrinal issues that need to be resolved.
So let me take you back to the CEO, the superstar CEO concept again. You and I were speaking before this call began about different things we heard in the oral arguments. And Jeff Wall, again, representing the company, argued to the court that the superstar CEO concept sort of invites a confusion between, on the one hand, legal control someone might have over a corporation, whether through ownership of shares or contractual rights or the ability to not really actually dominate the board, generally speaking, traditional control as distinguished from transaction-specific control. The CEO, superstar CEO concept invites a confusion between legal control in that sense and what he called influence, or I might call market power on the other. So in other words, I think the biggest threat Elon Musk could ever make to Tesla would be to say, you know what? I'm going to sell my shares and then I'm going to quit. Right. And I'm going to spend my time at SpaceX or one of his other companies. And of course, some people do have a great deal of power over a company precisely because they can do that. And replacing Elon Musk would not be an easy thing to do. But that's not legal control, is it? Right. I mean, the ability to hurt the company by saying, I'm done here, I quit, might be really important, tremendously important as a factual matter, but it's not legal control.
Yeah, well, a controller isn't a captive of the situation. And when you put a decision to the stockholders, at least my view is, you're putting to the people who whose best interests are coincided with how they frame the situation at the company at that time, and their view should be respected. Unless they're material omissions. I don't mean suggestions that the CEO or the alleged controller or whoever the officer or owner may be, I don't mean that they have personal relationships. Of course, they're going to have personal relationships. And I thought those issues were dealt with in the Martha Stewart case many years ago, that there are circumstances that clearly raise serious issues about it. But there are others that are just consistent with having good relationships within the entity and doing the best you can for the people that place their trust in you when they chose you as their fiduciary.
So let me ask you a question about that, because for years when I taught questions of independence of directors, I relied on Orman versus Coleman, where there's this wonderful footnote where Chancellor Chandler sets out what I thought was at the time the doctrine, and then, of course, the Martha Stewart case that you just mentioned. And back then, so this is, you know, around 2000, 2002, the way I understood the doctrine was that mere allegations of mere personal or business relationships between directors were insufficient to establish that a director lacked independence. Boards of directors aren't juries. We don't care, generally speaking, that they like each other, that they move in the same social circles, that they've been involved in other businesses or business deals in the past. You need something more specific than that. And then I believe, again, it's Leo Strein, it might be in the NFW opinion, he says, well, look, yes, mere allegations of mere friendship or mere business dealings are insufficient, but you can imagine a personal friendship that is sufficiently important to the people involved that it could lead a court to reasonably question the impartiality or independence. And Leo gives the example, you imagine two people who've known each other for decades. They were college roommates. They were maids of honor at each other's weddings. They go on vacation with their families together every year. They think of each other as sisters, even though they're not actually related. Is that could be different. But then when you get to this case, the Tesla case, you know, the court actually points out that, well, maybe director so-and-so didn't go to Elon Musk's wedding. Maybe he wasn't the best man at that wedding, but he did attend Elon's brother's wedding, right? So we've gone from maids of honor to attending a brother's wedding. You know, we've gotten, you know, it turns out it's now a material fact how many children's birthday parties people have gone to. The doctrine hasn't changed, the words haven't changed, but has the meaning changed in the 25 years since the Martha Stewart case?
No. I don't think so. One of my favorite Leo, and there are many, but one of my very favorites is when he was addressing independence and he talked about two people owning an airplane that they shared together. So they had a personalized investment that they didn't want to lose and found some merit in having that association. Perhaps that, given the surrounding context, would be a kind of line to draw. And that made perfect sense to me, that it's a personal investment shared by each other. Each is dependent on the other. You don't want your partner upset with you out of another scenario, another arena, and you lose that relationship. Now,
And for most people who could afford half a private jet, the jet's pretty important.
Well, I was going to say the only airplane I share with anyone's a paper one, and it was many, many years ago.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that there's some whiff of that in this case, right? Greg Varallo was, you know, emphasizing Elon Musk is the richest man on earth. He's, you know, obviously a very, very powerful man. This was the greatest pay package, the largest pay package in human history. I liked almost all the presentation. That I found a little off-putting. Certainly, it doesn't matter under Delaware law that Elon's the richest man in the world. He's supposed to, you know, it shouldn't matter, right? It shouldn't matter whether, you know, rich or poor should be getting the same standard of justice. While in general, I really liked a lot of Varallo's points, that one grated a bit.
Well, I thought Greg did an excellent job, but the whole concept of pointing a finger at this guy and saying, it's almost as if you were cynical, of course I'm not, but if one was cynical, one might say it's a kind of punish the rich to make you feel better about yourself, and overlooks the fact that this guy, yeah, he's very wealthy, but what has he done for people that have chosen to run risk with him?
Over the relevant time period, they increased their money by about a factor of 14.
Why is the fact he's successful when he's successful, not just for himself, but for other people? Why is that a kind of disabling factor that it's troublesome to read the case that way? I try not to read the case that way. Sort of just, it's a fact that he's a superstar. And
let's say that the plaintiffs actually substantially prevail on the merits and on the remedy. There were a couple of briefs, including from Joe Grunfest at Stanford, about the fees. Right? The fee was $345 million, calculated by looking at the accounting value, calculated under a Black-Scholes method, of the package on the date of grant. So back in 2018, when this package was granted, in accordance with GAAP and SEC rules, the company valued the package using the Black-Scholes method. And that value, that produced a number of $2.3 billion. The company took a charge against its earnings for that, just like it should. In calculating the benefit to the shareholders, the court below, Chancery Court, went back to this number, the $2.3 billion, took 15% of it to get the $345 million fee. One of the things that shows up in the briefs is that this number of $2.3 billion, it's very much an accounting fiction. The normal assumptions that you need to actually value something using Black-Scholes are never satisfied by executive comp options, right? So it's very much an accounting fiction number. If the plaintiffs win on the merits, but the fee is going to be looked into again, how would you go about calculating? I mean, what do you think would be the right way to calculate a fee? Did the Chancery Court get it right, or is there some other way it should have been done?
Well, call me old-fashioned, but I've always liked the five standards set in Sugarland for setting fees and use that as the benchmark for how to assess a fee. I don't know why this would be any different than that. And Delaware.
Can you elaborate on that for not everyone who knows what Sugarland is?
You're testing me to remember all five factors, and I didn't write them down.
Just mention the material ones.
Okay, one is the expertise of counsel, and well, the standard is reasonableness. That's, and then there are five ways of analyzing five factors to analyze to assure that you have it reasonable. The relative expertise and experience of counsel, the merits of the result attained and the benefit given to someone else. What is the standard fee generally in that area of the law for that result? And is there something extraordinary about that fee and whether the time spent was reasonable given the complexity of the case. Now, I may have misstated one or two of those or inaccurately articulated them, but those are the basics.
So I think by that standard, assuming this result holds, Greg Verwal is obviously entitled to a substantial fee. He's a very talented lawyer. This is a very complicated case. The numbers involved are very big. It's often said, though, that it's in the law, too, of course, that plaintiff's lawyers deserve, you know, an extra bump up in the fee because of the risk. They bring a lot of cases. Often they lose. They get zero on those cases to incentivize them properly to, in effect, act as private attorneys general and police boards. They need to get, you know, some type of multiplier, sometimes called a lodestar multiplier, because then they lose a lot of cases. And when they win, they have to be as effectively compensated for the ones they lose on, too. The lodestar multiplier, at least according to one of the amicus briefs here, was 25, whereas more usual ones, you know, are in the range of like 3 to 5. Do you think lodestar multipliers are a good idea? And if so, how big can they get?
No, Sugarland for me has always defined the right metric for determining what is a reasonable fee. And Delaware, in my experience, was unlike the federal courts in certain arenas, never has been a lodestar analysis. The risk is recognized, but the Sugarland five principles are the way to decide a fee, I think.
So they already built in the risk principle.
It's Sugarland cited in all the briefs that I read for the standard Delaware framework for analysis of what constitutes a reasonable fee. And it builds into it the recognition that there's risk involved, but it's not like someone who brings a civil rights case, which is hugely beneficial to a large number of people with no real reward otherwise than incentivizing lawyers to take on those cases because they might not otherwise do so. And that's in the federal system, and it makes sense there. We want public service oriented kind of lodestar rewards for great results for large numbers of people that are focused on humanitarian issues, in my view.
Especially people who aren't represented in the litigation, right? Their interests are affected, but they're not there in the courtroom.
Delaware's never been, at least on my time on the bench and the years I practiced afterwards and before, never been a lodestar case. It's a state.
I mean, I think the implication was that if you calculated Verwal's stated fee and the number of hours and so on, you just don't get, I mean, obviously you're not going to get to $345 million or anywhere close to it. One of the other fee issues that came up in connection with the fee was the size of the benefit. And you know, one way you could look at the size of the benefit, you could say, well, they've saved the company $56 billion. Presumably you have to subtract from that whatever Musk is going to get in lieu of his $56 billion, assuming the package stays rescinded. If that's right, would you, or does that sound right to you? I mean, shouldn't the benefit be $56 billion minus something? Or is the whole benefit the $56
billion? I'm not sure how to answer that. That's always been a difficult thing. It's not quite as bad as an appraisal case, but it's the next worst thing that a member of the court has to do in the course of regular course of business. So I'm not comfortable answering that, to be honest.
Okay. I mean, there was one question. I think it was Justice Vallahora who said, assuming we rescind, wouldn't Musk at that point be entitled to bring a quantum merit argument, a quantum merit case against the company? I would assume that generally speaking, he would.
Well, I think there'd have to be analysis of it. I haven't dealt much with what the right word remedies involving quantum merit. So I'm not sure of all the principles behind it right now.
I think that probably goes back to Karen Vallahore's other point that this is such an unprecedented thing, right? To have a fully performed executive comp package rescinded after the fact. Yeah. Only in a situation like that would the executive come back and say, well, I did all this, now you owe me something for it. It would be yet another unprecedented question.
Yeah, I don't like the way that plays out, but I'm not comfortable being confident in any answer I would give you.
Right, we're almost out of time. Any final thoughts you have about the case, about what you saw this morning? When you think the court will rule? Because I'm sure we're all anxious to find out.
That's the one thing I definitely disappoint you by saying. I don't want to predict how they're going to rule, because it's my experience, the dynamic when the five get together to discuss this case, the process has always been the junior justice speaks first and then the chief justice speaks last. And I can remember sitting in the room saying, whatever you all do, do not bring it to me for the last decision. But the dynamic in the conversations, a wonderful experience. It's hard to describe the kind of relationship that develops on that court, and the focus is on what is in the long-term best interest of all the constituency that this court represents, and in the corporate law area and in others as well, but mostly in the corporate law area. It's all about maintaining a reputation for clarity, consistency, which produce predictability. And that's where we need to be. To the extent there's confusion, it's the Supreme Court's job to sort it out. And to the extent there needs to be changes in the corporate law, that's corporate counsel and the Delaware Bar's submission to the General Assembly to sort it out. Anything in between, I think, is harmful to the process and harmful to the reputation of our court system. That it's not an accident that our court can have no more than a majority of one political party on each of our major courts. And that standard will remain, even though now settling it, an issue that we can also have what's fashionably called independence in the on the bench in the northern county and declines in the southern two counties. So maintaining that kind of harmony is really important to the process, and we'll see that, and we'll get from this court a very thoughtful and a very well articulated position on the critical issues that you outlined it in the beginning.
We have one question in the chat, which I will read to you. Has there been an impact on new incorporations in Delaware and or reincorporations in other jurisdictions? I know that as a result of this case, the writer says he can no longer advise clients to incorporate in Delaware. I think the answer to that is clearly there has not been. There have been plenty of new incorporations in Delaware.
We've talked about that before. There's no Drexit, I think some people like to call it.
Eight or nine public companies.
Yeah, the real focus should be on IPOs, new corporations, newly formed corporations, whether they're subsidiaries or whether they're major corporations. Most people that have been here understand every decade or so there's a bump in the road, but it gets sorted out over time. And it used to be said quite accurately that in the corporate law area, it was once every decade that there was a 3-2 decision from the Delaware Supreme Court. So it'll all get worked out.
Do you anticipate this being other than a unanimous decision?
Oh, that is. Well, I'll answer that as if I was running for office. Well, I hope it's a unanimous decision.
Fair enough. Chief Justice, thank you so much for doing this. Maybe we'll be able to get together and talk again when the opinion comes out.
No, that sounds good to me. I appreciate the time.
Thank you. I appreciate your being here and sharing with, all your thoughts with us. It's always been always a pleasure and always an honor, sir.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Thank you.
Don, Matthew, I can leave now, right?
Yes, you can. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for their valuable time and expertise today. And I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email, fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. As always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.